Welcome, everyone, to Library Voices SC, the podcast of the South Carolina State Library. And it's a pleasure to be here today with Sophie Blackhall as one of our award-winning illustrators at the Storyfest South Carolina 2017. This is the seventh annual Storyfest held at the South Carolina State Museum and sponsored by the South Carolina State Library. And welcome, Sophie.
Thank you so much. I am very excited to be here, excited to see the line growing outside of families. I hear expecting up to 2,000 people today, which is extraordinary.
Oh, yeah, and we've had over 2,000, you know, so it's really, really wonderful to see.
It's an amazing thing. I'm so happy to be part of it.
Well, thank you. And it's, you know, it's just this great way to kick off summer reading statewide and give kids a chance to get wonderful books in their hands and also to meet authors and illustrators.
The fact that children leave with a book is so wonderful, because it's one thing to share a story and to interact with kids and to tell them about this book, but then when they actually get to take it home and read it and it can be then part of their library, is that gave me goosebumps when I found out that was happening.
And the really neat thing that I love is that it's also a book signing, and so it's sometimes a kid's first introduction to what a book signing is about and getting to talk to and meet authors and illustrators. It's really exciting.
I did an event recently with such a thing, and a girl came up to me at the end of it, and she said, "I didn't know girls could do that." And I said, "Do what?" And she said, "Make books." And I said, "Oh, honey, girls can do anything."
Exactly. That's a wonderful, wonderful sentiment. I want to talk a little bit about one of your books that you have illustrated. And by the way, I will say that you are a very celebrated artist, and your work has appeared in the best-selling Ivy and Bean series. And you've gotten many awards, and you also worked as part of an international pro-literacy campaign with Save the Children, and you've also got your artwork on a New York subway poster. Tell us about that.
That was so much fun. It was in 2012, and it was on subways across the city of New York, and there are 8 million people in New York, and I think most of them ride the subway at some point or other, and a large number of them emailed me to say that they'd seen themselves in this poster, and I had the most incredible interactions with total strangers for the duration of the year. Every day my inbox was flooded, and it was really overwhelming and a lot of fun.
That's really, really neat. And while we're talking about New York is far away from where you grew up, isn't it? Because
it
I think
is.
Your accent is maybe from down under.
My accent is a little distorted these days, but I am from Australia. I grew up in the country in Australia, spent most of my summers up a tree with a book with my brother, who was further up the tree because he was older and he got the better branch. But we shared our books. We had a rope system with baskets.
And oh, how wonderful.
We'd exchange books and then lower the basket in the hopes that my mother would put snacks in it, which she never did. But, you know, you live in hope. That's mm-hmm. what childhood is all about, mm-hmm. hope
exactly.
of snacks.
Exactly. It is. This book that I've got here, which is a Caldecott Medal winning book, and it's called Finding Winnie, The True Story of the World's Most Famous Bear, and this is by Lindsay Maddock and illustrated by you, Sophie Blackhall. And, you know, I looked through this book. The artwork is absolutely amazing and just beautiful, but I really didn't realize that Winnie the Pooh was a real bear.
Neither did I. And so Winnie the Pooh may be my favorite book of all time. It was the first book I bought with my own money as a child. And I think that first book that you get as a kid, that you really choose yourself, going to a library and choosing a book is fantastic, but then you have to give it back. Being given a book is a wonderful thing, but the first book that you actually choose and buy with your own money is memorable. And mine was Winnie the Pooh, and it was the first book where I really felt this writer is speaking to me, and these characters became my lifelong friends. And so to receive this manuscript and get to illustrate the true story of this bear, and the story very briefly is that there was an orphan black bear cub on a train station platform discovered by a soldier on his way to World War I in Canada. He'd come from Winnipeg. He was a vet, and he saw this bear cub, and knew that there was something special about this bear, so he took her with him and named her Winnipeg, after his home place, Winnie for short, and they became inseparable. When time came to actually go to battle in France, he had to leave her behind, and he took her to live at the London Zoo, where she charmed everyone who met her, but most notably, of course, a small boy named Christopher Robin, whose father, A.A. Milne, wrote some of the most beloved stories of all time about bear and boy, and that was Winnie.
And it really is amazing when you look through the book, you even see photographs in the back. But yeah. Just for a second, can you talk about your wonderful illustrations, what kind of process you do, maybe what thought process you go through? Because the illustrations, and you have to get your hands on this book, are just beautiful.
Oh, thank you. It was such a joy to illustrate it. It took about a year, and before that was several months of research. And I had the honor and the privilege of having access to the family records, because the author, Lindsay Matic, is the vet, the soldier, Harry Colborne's real-life great-granddaughter. So she had in her family treasures Harry's diary from the war, in which he actually wrote, you know, on August 24th, 1914, bought bear $20 at the White River train station. So to be able to actually hold this diary and look at the photographs and talk to Lindsay was wonderful. Then I traveled to London and visited the London Zoo and saw where Winnie lived and looked in the archives and read news clippings about, you know, what an extraordinary, remarkable bear she was and how beloved for her entire lifetime. And I went to see where the soldiers trained on the Salisbury Plain and looked at maps in the Imperial War Museum and read soldiers' diaries. And so I really immersed myself in the research, which is some of the best fun for me. I love uncovering the secrets and clues that make up the story.
Well, your artwork definitely shows your high level of research and also your fascination. You can tell through your artwork you have such a fascination with the topic.
Indeed, and there's something about a physical book and being able to hold it in your hands and turn the pages, especially a picture book that is large, that you can share with a friend or your child or your parent. And this is a book that seems to appeal to all generations, which makes me really happy, because I think picture books are for everyone. I've never grown out of picture books, and I don't think anybody should. But to actually have this physical book and turn the pages and to make such a book is just such a fantastic process, because you really are thinking about the page turn and how you want to reveal what's happening next and how you want to move through the story and how you want to actually, you know, be part of the way that the picture bleeds off one page and you know, turns into something new on the next page. It's discovery and exploration and adventure.
It is, and that leads me to my last question is, you know, when a child or parent or anyone is in a public library, they're able to do that same kind of thing, browse the shelves and find out something that speaks to them. And what's your experience with libraries?
Libraries are some of my favorite places on earth, and librarians are quite honestly my heroes. The work that librarians do across this country is... I can't even find words
to describe.
Just leaves
you speechless, doesn't
it? It does. I can't really articulate how important it is, especially, dare I say it, you know, in these times. It's not just finding the right book to put into a child's hands at the right moment that will quite possibly change their lives, mm-hmm. But it's reaching out to whole families and communities and providing the support. I've met librarians across the country who are not only lending books, but are lending, you know, computers or, you know, filmmaking, documentary, archiving kind of things, but also, you know, slow cookers. And
yeah,
there are libraries that have, you know, things that really support people in all kinds of circumstances. And and it's a home. It's a second home for people. It's a reaching out hand. It's a mm-hmm. That was very badly put, but it is. It's a helping
hand.
Hand. In all kinds of aspects of life, and so I have enormous gratitude and respect for libraries. We were so dependent on our library in Brooklyn when I first moved there, and my children were tiny because we lived in a minuscule apartment and it was a blizzardy winter and we had nowhere to go, and we spent our days at the library, and my son learned to walk there, and we met the librarians. Wow. And the other thing I love about borrowing books from a library is thinking about all the people who have read this book before.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's this sort of connection, especially if it's an old book. And, you know, they used to have the catalog cards at the back, which I would love. And I'd look out who, you know, had checked this book out in right. dates going past. And I would feel bad for a book that hadn't been checked out in
right.
a few years, that
right.
had sort of languished on the shelves. And but it did feel like this connection to other readers. And I love that about books, that, you know, there is that lovely thing about buying a new book that belongs to you, but there's an equally lovely thing about reading a book that you know other people have read and passing that book along and sharing that story.
And hopefully Finding Winnie is in a whole lot of libraries.
I would love to think so.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we're back. This is Curtis Rogers again, South Carolina State Library. So happy to be here with Rita Williams Garcia, an author who is here at Storyfest South Carolina, here at the State Museum. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's so good to have you here. Rita, she has this amazing resume. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She is winner of the Penn Norma Klein Award. She's the author of One Crazy Summer. And this book that I've got in my hand, which is a sequel to the Newbery Honor book, One Crazy Summer, is PSB11. And it's got a great cover. And it's considered a young adult. What age group is this?
Oh, this is, I would say, from 9 to 14.
Okay. And I just want to talk a little bit with you about your writing style. What got you interested into writing for the YA audience?
Okay. Well, my goal, my desire in life had always been to write books. And I read a lot of adult authors as a child, so it didn't occur to me to write children's books or to write for teens. But when I was in college, I went to Hofstra University, and I'm in an Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority, mm-hmm. and we had a literacy kind of mission. And so I worked with high school students who were reading under grade level. I was trying to find a book that I thought these girls would relate to. Mm-hmm. Now, picture this. This is the 1970s, mm-hmm. and there weren't a whole lot of books with African American girls or girls of color. And so I looked. I wanted to use The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, mm-hmm. but I was losing them. I said, you know, one day you're going to come back to this. So in the meanwhile, I was taking this class with Richard Price, the mm-hmm. author of Blood Brothers, The Wanderers, and The Wire. Anyway, and I was working on character development. So I thought, I thought of my students, and I created this character. At that time, her name was Tawanda, and I would put her in situations, and then I would bring my homework to my reading group, and they would get engrossed in the story and offer suggestions and want to know what would happen next. So I started typing really fast, and before I knew it, I had a manuscript that I eventually got an agent for.
How cool. That's an exciting story. And when you said Tawanda, you know what that reminded me of?
Tawana Brawley.
It reminded me of Fried Green Tomatoes.
Oh!
Because remember, that wasn't there a...
Yes, yes.
It's a wonderful, wonderful name. So tell me a little bit about PSB 11. What drew you to write this story?
Okay, so in the first book, the girls travel from Brooklyn to Oakland to meet their mother, their estranged mother. She is a poet involved with the Black Panthers. So they get a little bit of that out there. Mm-hmm. And now they come back to Brooklyn, back to their very traditional Negro grandmother, Big Ma, who has no time for the Black Panthers or any kind of militancy or revolution of any kind. And so while they are home, they're seeing there's so much change going on just in the little time that they were gone. Their father has an announcement, so things are about to change at home. There's revolution in the air. A woman, Shirley Chisholm, is running for Congresswoman, and so forth. So there's all of these things that are happening. But I think the one main change that really has the girls' fascination is they see this boy group on TV with big afros and dance and sing like I don't know what, the Jackson 5, and they're screaming when they should be in bed, and Big Ma wakes up and makes them go to bed. Well, anyway, so these girls want to see the Jacksons in the most terrible way, and so it's all about them working together to try to get to see the Jacksons while all these other changes are going on in the family and in the community, and it all does come together.
Well, you know, what's so important about a book like this and your writing is that you're not only, you know, giving an experience to a student or a young reader, but you're teaching history.
Oh, without a doubt.
I mean, you're teaching history because, you know, maybe in school, students might not be learning about the plant,
the Black Panthers.
They might not be learning about the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And so what kind of importance do you place on incorporating that kind of history into your writing?
Well, you know, it's very funny about history. People are always saying, no, don't look back, keep looking forward. Well, you have to kind of know what happened before, so when you see little signs of it, you go, oh! And, you know, bells should ring, and you should know what it means and possibly what the activism, you know, what you should do about that. If I can give you an example in the book. Okay, it's going to take me a second to find it.
No, go right ahead, because, you know, it's these kind of things that so important to pull in young readers with not only topics that they're interested in, but you're also educating them.
And, oh, sure.
And that's such an important factor in writing, because a lot of students, you know, they find something that they may not know anything about, but then they start learning, and that's what your books do.
So I was around for a lot of this good stuff, so I remember quite a bit. I'm going to read a page and a half. Big Ma had gone down to Friendship Baptist Church to hear Senator Kennedy tell the Black people they were American citizens who deserve decent homes, decent education for their children, safe neighborhoods, and opportunities. But Big Ma talked more about taking off her glove to shake a Kennedy's hand than she talked about his speech. You'd have thought Big Ma would have been baking cookies for the Vote for Bobby office on Fulton Street, the way she talked and talked about Senator Kennedy. But she said she wouldn't vote for him because his hair was too long and he let people call him Bobby and not Robert. He was too young, talking about changing things in Bedford-Stuyvesant and in every other ghetto. She said that while that sounded good and people hollered and clapped for him, he was still a rich young Catholic boy whose daddy made millions selling liquor. Instead, she planned to vote Republican for Richard M. Nixon. who, to Big Ma, was more suited to be president of the United States than a Catholic boy with hippie hair, or any Democrat for that matter. She and Pa talked back and forth about that. After the assassination, Big Ma told Pa not to waste his vote on the Democrats. Instead of fixing things for the Negro race, Richard Nixon would win the war in Vietnam, clean up the country of its long-haired, drug-smoking hippies, and get those black militants and bean pie-selling Muslims in line. He would make America great.
Wow, that's powerful. That's, you know, I mean, and I don't think a lot of, you know, young adult books are getting into this kind of history. And so that's why I think it's so important. So thank you for sharing that with us.
You are welcome.
One last question I wanted to ask, and being at the State Library and being a librarian myself, what kind of importance do you place on libraries, and what's your experience with libraries?
Oh, my experience with libraries just goes way, way back. I'll confine it to when I was 12 years old and I said, I am serious about being a writer. The first place I went to was the St. Albans Library right around the corner from my grandmother's house. And I went straight to the reference section and checked out the Writer's Market.
Oh, wow.
And the Writer's Handbook. And I took them home, and I had my own little writer's book. And so I took notes, and I learned how to prepare a manuscript.
At 12?
Oh, yeah. how to prepare a manuscript, how to send a self-addressed stamped envelope, how to write a query letter, and all the different markets and what they were asking for in terms of submissions.
That's heavy-duty research.
Oh, you better believe it, but I was on a mission. Mm-hmm. I had stories to write, and I was going to sell them. Now, the stories that I was writing at that time, I read mostly adult novels, so the stories that I was going to write, I had a story about a Las Vegas private detective,
ooh,
alcoholic, down on his luck,
oh my goodness,
with alimony problems. And so,
isn't it amazing what you can come up with?
And in my head, uh-huh, I had casted Frank Sinatra to play that part.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
Another bit of history.
I was very focused.
That's
great. And it didn't occur to me to write for children yet, but the library was just such a refuge. Even then, as a high schooler, that was back in junior high, as a high schooler, the central library was really, it was strategic and an important hub, mm-hmm, because most of us kids were bused into other neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So the library was central, and it was right across the street from the bus station.
Ah.
And so this was an opportunity to get to meet with kids from all over Queens, mm, at this library.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you had the usual things going on in the library, a lot of study groups, mm-hmm, and, you know, projects and things like that. But you also had things like, you had graffiti artists getting together.
Wow.
And kind of looking, kind of critiquing each other's work and giving each other advice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you had young rappers,
mm-hmm,
you know, with their notebooks, thesauruses, rhyming dictionaries.
And what is rap but poetry?
Exactly.
I mean, they're studying poetry at the library.
Exactly. And they would get together and you know, and yeah, work hard. And then, you know, you had your usual hijinks. You had, you know, this group of girls over here and that group of guys and the nerdy girl runner who would eagerly take, back then it was paper, mm-hmm, the note over to the guy's section.
Oh, sure.
And then run back, and then someone would come back, and so forth and so on. You had a lot of that going on.
Oh, yeah.
But in our neighborhood in particular, especially that Queens Central Library that's central to everything, you have so many immigrant families,
sure,
there using not just the book, you know, the stacks, mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm, books, services, but there's so much community outreach. Mm-hmm. There's English second language. There's immigration help, counseling. Mm-hmm. You can get guitar lessons there.
Oh, yeah.
There's homework. Parents who don't speak English wanting to help their kids with homework. And so you might have someone at the library who can come and help kind of facilitate so that the parent is very much involved. We even have a video visitation room for children who might have an incarcerated parent.
Wow.
And so they're able to read a book to that incarcerated parent and have that, you know, just have that exchange, have that visit. So there is so much going on in the library. A library, I mean, back in my day, I thought it was the greatest thing. Uh-huh. But when I walk in now, it is huge. It is tremendous. The children's room is now the Discover Zone. And you have this. Before, I remember we used to have like a couple of computers that people mm-hmm. could use. Now it's a computer room bigger than
rows
this.
And rows and rows.
Rows and rows of computers. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's all access and it's just so invaluable. So that's why it has to be protected. Mm-hmm. And we all have to rally behind it when funds are threatened.
Exactly.
Because you can't have real community without a library.
That's right, and you can't have a true democratic society without libraries, so that people can research and learn on their own,
yes.
You know, because it's just more than what you learn in school.
Oh, sure, sure.
It goes beyond and beyond, and much like in your book, how you educate us and educate young adults. So we certainly do appreciate you being here, and thank you for talking to us.
You are so welcome. My pleasure.